My name is Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I really love Eugene, Oregon. I really love being here. And I've got so many friends in this room. I've been here a lot. And if you've heard my story before, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. I could start out by saying I was a small Polynesian woman when I got here. And, you know, I mean, I could just tell a whole different story, but I'm not going to. My wife's here, and... Has everybody met my adorable wife, Nancy? Would you stand up and be adored? She's just the cutest thing on earth, and I'm absolutely nuts about her. And I used to think that she was the source of all the evil on the planet. I used to wake up and look at her jugular vein pumping blood to her brain and think, can we just put a stop to that? I mean, what if I just held my finger on it for a while? Would that do it? And now I just think she's the cutest thing in the whole world. I'm just nuts about her. And if you're new, I'm sure you're just thrilled to death for us. I'm sure you're overwhelmed. Harlan, you got me? You all right? That's Harlan the taper, who's yawning way before I even walked up here. I just want to tell you that. And I don't think that my talk tonight can make the meeting any better for me. I started crying about three times while I was sitting there. I looked at my friend Harlan, who I love, and I looked at my wife, and I looked out of the crowd at all the people here who I know and who I just adore. And I just one more time said to myself, I'm absolutely free. I'm absolutely free in this world. And I never breathed a free moment in my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I fancied myself a free man. In the second paragraph page 62 in our book, it says, we're driven. Driven is not nudged or influenced. Driven implies under the lash of, in slavery to, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. It owned me. Alcohol, you know, and I fancy myself a free man, and the fact is I did whatever alcoholism told me to do. I did it every time it told me to do it, and I did it whenever it told me to do it. Every time. I showed up for work every time. And Eugene is particularly meaningful for me. I spent a great weekend with a group of guys in Mackenzie Bridge in Eugene, and I've spoken up here a bunch. One of the last times I came up here, our older son was graduating high school and decided to join a commune. And he allowed me, so I drove him up to Eugene. He was going to visit a commune up here. And he allowed me to visit a couple of colleges on the way, just like mercy sex, though. You know, it was like they were mercy visits to college. He had absolutely no intention on attending any of them. And we got up... here, and I'll never forget, I'm driving him to the commune, and I had called my friend Harry, and he had scheduled me to talk at a meeting once I got up here, and the convention at Seaside was going on, so my friend Cliff was over there, and I got to go and hang out. Everyone just took care of me, you know, and I was so grateful. And I'm going to drop my kid off at the commune, and we're in the car, and I went, oh, no, he doesn't smell good. He's got body odor. I said, Scott, you're taking him to the body odor capital of the world, you know? I'm taking him to a commune. I'm afraid he doesn't smell good enough for the commune. And I got him up there, and I'm driving on, and I'm just saying, just thank God his mother's not here. She'd be holding the bloody stump of his leg in her arms right now, because she might have had maybe a difficult time letting go. And He decided not to go to the commune. Instead, he did something safe. And he went down to Chiapas, Mexico, and worked with the Zapatista revolutionaries for a while. It was a much less anxiety-producing thing for us. And my sponsor did something for me that time when Micah was down in Chiapas. That he's done for me many times. He said to me, you know, Scott, I am so spiritually developed that when you realize later on that this is one of the great things that ever could have happened, I'm not going to rub it in. And, you know, it's just one of the great things that ever happened. It's the greatest experience our son ever had. You know, and a year later, when one more time I was driving him up. He decided to go to college over up in Evergreen College, which, you know, makes sense. You can get a soy latte there 24 hours a day. And Nancy's checking him in, and, you know, all the other kids are, you know, their moms are checking him into the dorm, and they're flipping out. And our kid's been to Chiapas. He doesn't give a crap. He's saying, make the bed, do whatever you want. I mean, he had the, had this huge experience. And I don't know if he went down there because of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. I know that we were okay with it because of that. I know that, you know, the Mexican military is depicted as such a kind, loving, caring group of people. It really was a terrible... I'd get pounded by these really quite substantially miserable images of stuff that could have happened to my kid. They didn't want my kid down there. And I just, you know, I'd take the third step in the morning and I'd take my walk and I'd say, Pop, take the Mexican military. You can have them too. Because I don't think I'm going to be able to handle this at all. And one day I just got pounded by it and I couldn't turn them over and I called my sponsor and he said to me that morning, he said, you know, this just might be one of the greatest things that ever happens to him, and it has been. And so I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here. I'm sorry I missed my wife's talk this morning. She always gives a great talk. She shares some in our area, I always like telling this story just in case anybody thinks she's too spiritually developed. In our area, one of the Al-Anon sayings that, you know, if you get embroiled in an argument with your significant other, that you might say, you know, you could be right. You might be right. And that's a good tool to have, you know, so maybe you don't hit a stalemate. And one day we were kind of getting into it in the car, and my wife turned to me and she said, you know, honey, you could be right, but not today. No, not today. Perhaps some other day, but not right now. I talked at Oceanside a couple of years ago. Seaside? Seaside, right? And this guy up there heard me, and he was in a recovery home up there. And he figured I was the guy. I was the guy who was going to keep him sober. All I had to do, if he could, and he called his brother up. His brother lived in L.A. And he said, look, I finally found the guy who can do it. This guy, I don't know how I'm going to get in touch with him, but I got to get in touch with this guy. And his brother said, well, who's the guy? And the guy said, well, this guy's Scott Redmond. And his brother said, you're a moron. He's been my sponsor for 10 years. You've met him 20 times. You've had dinner with him. You've got the mind of a chicklet. And this guy cannot get sober. He's fabulously wealthy, tremendously wealthy. Someone actually had the audacity to say to me, "Well, he's just got too much money to stop drinking." Wow! Let's go down to Skid Row and take all their dough away. They'll never drink again. I mean, what a missed call. Bad call. But he had one of his other incredibly wealthy friends sequester him on a desert island, on a Caribbean island, and he didn't drink until he got off. It's just one of those incredible stories of someone with these extraordinary resources cannot stop drinking. So he was on another trip to Oregon on a rehab. He came down, and he had me over to his house. I sponsored him for about 11 minutes, and he showed me this. This was it. He had bought a copy of the original pressing, first edition of the Big Book, one of the big books. I think there's 100 left. He bought one of them for $7,000 in cash, and he got it, and there was no way that an owner of this book would be able to. And he said, look, it's perfect. It's not even marked. And I said, wow, it doesn't even look like it's been read. He said, no, it hasn't. I said, so this has been handed down from loser to loser for 60 years. And now you've got the loser book, the great $7,000 loser book. And he sold it to, on his next run. He sold it on his next run. Because he had had a lawyer sign up papers to make it impossible for him to get to his money. Because that, if he couldn't get to his money, get sober. So he sold the original big book to God knows who to complete a run. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to AA. And just suggest that you catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. If you don't have it, we would like to give it to you. I'd like to welcome the new exotic group of people. I'm very excited that you're here. Welcome, tweakers. If you're applauding, you probably now no longer remember why you're applauding. catch alcoholism. Even if you're like the Bigfoot of dope addicts, even if you're like a dope Goliath, you know, catch alcoholism. We don't have a book for Dope Goliath. We have a book about alcoholism written by alcoholics. I got here, I did not have alcoholism. Didn't have it. Didn't catch it for a while. People who don't catch it die from it, a lot of them. And people who catch it get better. I have a terrible case of it now, but it's developed over a period of time. My alcoholism is way, way worse now than it was when I got here. If you're new here, I want to tell you I am not as close to my next drink as you are, me personally. My not drinking muscle is a lot stronger than yours. Your drinking muscle is a lot stronger than mine. It's been getting a lot of exercise lately. I only have till 12 o'clock tonight, just like you. I only get to do this thing one day at a time. But I really, for me, this is going to be a good talk tonight. Any talk I don't talk, I don't drink during or afterward is a good talk. I've got too big an ego to drink right after I talk. I figure if I go out, I'll do it while I'm talking, you know? Just light up a big spliff and just, you know, and not even mention it, just, you know. At any rate, and I'm sure there's some newcomer out there who goes, this is cool. I did not have alcoholism when I got here. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And, you know, you don't want to squander any agony opportunity. And the funny thing is when I was new, one of the first guys that saved my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I want to tell you, the steps did not save my life when I came to AA. I would not have known a step if it had bit me on the rump. Many other things kept me coming back. It wasn't a step, I'll tell you that. And I was a couple of weeks sober, and I was at a meeting, and a guy said that he said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means that I do not believe in God, and I'm therefore positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I went, wow. I said, man, I get that totally. I totally get that. I had been introduced to an Old Testament God that I would not be caught in a dark alley with. This God got your ass no matter what. He got you. Got you, got you, got you. He turned your wife to salt and killed your goat and put a finger in your eye and got your ass no matter what. So when I came here, I thought I had neatly evaded this thing. I really did. I thought I had skipped this completely. So, you know, if you're new, you can find out what we're going to do to you right now. Read the sadistic seventh chapter of this book. It's all in here. We're going to do it to you anyway. It says in the sadistic seventh chapter, talk to a drunk while they're down. Preferably right after they've come off a horrible bender. Talk to them when they're at a horribly depressed, crushed up, destroyed point. Get them to identify with you. Get them to laugh with you. Get them to cry with you. And once you're really there with them, heap upon them evidence as to the hopelessness of their situation. Then stress the spiritual angle freely. Always good news for the new man. So I want to welcome you if you're new. If you're bored, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell you my favorite story about being bored in AA. If you're a newcomer and you're bored, happened to an old friend of mine named Jeff D. And he was new, had a couple of weeks, and he was at a meeting shifting around in his seat, and his sponsor said to him, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'm bored." And his sponsor said, "Well, you know why you're bored." Jeff said, "No." And his sponsor said, "You're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored." And it was like an acid moment for him. He went, whoa. It freaked him out, man. It blew him away. He thought, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer, right? He could hardly wait till the newcomer told him that they were bored. 13 years later, no newcomer has told him that they're bored. He's at a meeting with a young lady at our old home group, the North Hollywood group in L.A., and this young lady shifting around in her seat, and Jeff said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I'm bored." He said, "Well, you know why you're bored." She said, "Yeah, because I'm with you." I grew up in New York City in the Bronx to a family that was and is still completely out of their minds. They're still nuts. Just a couple of years ago, my mom calls me and says, "Honey, I've got bad news for you." I said, "What?" She says, "Aunt Lena's dead." I said, "Oh, no, Mom, when?" "A year and a half ago." I said, "What?" She said, "Well, you know, your Aunt Phyllis is back in the mental institution, and she calls me and harasses me, so I haven't been picking up the phone, but I found out Phyllis has been dead a couple of weeks. I started answering the phone again and found out that Lena died." This is my genetic pool. These are my people. I have an aunt. My Aunt Rose came to our engagement party and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. These people were insane. Insane. I had an uncle who was one of the top 10 welterweights of the world during the 1930s. He was concerned about anti-Semitism. He was fighting in Atlanta and changed his name from Izzy Redmond to Izzy Goldberg so no one would know he was Jewish. This is my genetic pool. These are my people. You don't brag about this. My wife met him and she couldn't. I had understated the problem. I had not exaggerated. These people are absolutely cuckoo. And if you're new, all I can tell you is it had nothing to do with making me an alcoholic. Now, if you're new, that really might be confusing because you might come from a terrible place. I am not telling you didn't. I am not telling you that you didn't come from a terrible place, and if terrible stuff happened to you, I ain't saying boo-hoo. I'm saying I believe you. What I'm saying is you can't make a drunk that way in this man. If you could, I could have gone to therapy and I could have worked it out. If I was made a drunk by those insane people, and I'm taught there was chronic institutionalization, suicide attempts, mental and physical abuse, awful stuff. I'm not saying I didn't have to do stuff about all of that stuff. I did and I still do. But if that had made me an alcoholic, I could go to therapy and work out my family problems and I'd be okay. I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, "Oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier." Right? I could just be like the normal people. But if you have alcoholism, I love reasons to drink. They're just my favorite things in the whole world. I collect them, you know. And I have a friend named Larry. The first time he ever read our book, he read the first page of the fourth chapter of the book, which contains a sentence that says, loosely, "Facing an alcoholic death or a spiritual life is not always an easy decision to make." And the first time he ever read that sentence, when he was new, he said to himself, "Well, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here?" That's not a normal reaction to that. That's not something a normal person would think. My favorite reason to drink I have ever heard in my life, and it still is my favorite. It's been going on a couple of years now. I was sponsoring a guy for about 15 minutes, and he lived with his wife. He was a male prostitute, and he had a gay lover, and he called me to tell me that he drank. And I said, "Oh, why?" And he said, he said, "I caught my wife cheating on me." And you can't make that up. You can't. And I'll tell you, you tell that story at the Lions Club, no one laughs. Nobody laughs. They look at you like cows watching a passing train. But AA gets it. Because we get it. We know that that's the product of one or two processes. That was either just, man, a gem. Pow. He had to come up with something, and he came up with it. It was fully cut cloth. You know, boom. Or that was the product of weeks in the rat's maze. Weeks on the hamster wheel. Weeks and weeks of turning the whole world. You got to turn the whole world to get to that place. All right, I know, I live with my wife, I'm a hooker with a beeper, I've got a gay lover, but the bitch cheated on me! I'm out of here! You gotta turn the universe so it can slide in, slot by slot by slot. And how many times has the newcomer shared their plan with us, and you just go, wow! Wow! It's like somebody picks up their brain and goes, and then puts it back in again. Because the alcoholic mind is like the most perfectly tuned clock that keeps the most precise time in the universe for 1 minute. And then it skips a century. When it works. It is gorgeous. It's rhapsodic. It's beautiful. And when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through. It's absolutely remarkable. So if you have this weird thinking and it's coupled with a physical reaction to alcohol that makes it impossible to control and enjoy once you begin, or to moderate once you begin. And if you're special and you're a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, not in the mood today, and blow it out. Hatch will fill the air. If you have that physical reaction and it gets hooked up with that thinking, once a certain kind of thinking becomes established in someone with alcoholic tendencies, they've probably placed themselves beyond human help. Always good news for the new man. And then this horrible spiritual tapeworm takes place that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone, and I try to treat that with psychotherapy. That's like showing up at a gunfight with a knife once a week. And again, I'm not putting therapy down. I got no beef with it. It says in our book on page 133, if you need a doctor, go get one. I use therapy all the time. I don't use it to treat alcoholism. It was a colossal blunder. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to AA. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting it down for a second. But as a treatment for alcoholism, I almost died. I was doing good work in psychotherapy. I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict, but really dead. And I grew up in this family, and in addition to therapy, which I was put into at the age of 14 because I fell into this alcoholic dilemma almost immediately. The other way that I tried to avoid alcoholism is I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW, what, WOW, what, WOW, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's a lot of activity, but no movement. But they're busy, busy, very busy people. I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gall-darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. I drank throughout. I don't mean to annoy anybody by talking about drugs. Mike, could you raise your hand? He asked me to talk. Not my fault. I wasn't looking for the business, so if I piss you off, see Mike. after the meeting and leave me alone. But I almost died from alcoholism because I tried to dodge it with the drug deal. And I was in my early 20s. I slammed some dope that day, and my father had a massive stroke, and I was loaded on heroin the night that he died. And my sweet, sweet dad, who was just an adorable man with a great heart and who adored me. And I couldn't show up for him or my mom or my brother. My father was lost to me. And I knew what the problem was, and I knew how to solve it. I just swore I'd never put a needle in my arm again, and I didn't. And as long as I didn't, I was okay. It was one of those things, and if you're a member of AA, I don't have to explain this to you, that any time my father's name came up, it was like I got hit in the head with the side of a brick. I couldn't think about him. I couldn't talk about him. I couldn't look at pictures of him. And I don't know what that is for you. And I want to tell you something. I don't care if it's your houseplant. I don't care if one day you looked up and you realized that you had let your houseplants die and that was your bottom. That's as good a bottom as my dad was for me eventually. You know? I really believe that if I start putting a premium on people's pain, I've really missed the boat here. You know, and whatever it is that has mirrored that reality to you, because I know for me that once the drink in my hand stopped having a connection to the condition of my life, I was a dead man and nothing was going to stop me. Nothing that ever got in between me and a drink stopped me from getting to the drink. Shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play. And a new usherette walked in with long brown hair, and I took one look at this woman. I walked back into the dressing room. I got up on a chair, and I announced to the male men in this cast, I said, if anyone talks to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'll break all the bones in your hands and feet. And anytime Nancy would, like, go near a guy, he'd kind of go, and dash away. And I just, you know, I fell in love with her when I met her, and I've loved her ever since. And sure enough. I know that was a newcomer because the newcomers are so overwhelmed with joy for Nancy and I. If you're new and you're sitting there and thinking, maybe you and your wife will blow up, huh? I like your talk. Maybe your face will burst into flame while you're talking, huh? That would be pretty cool, don't you think? Welcome to AA, because I didn't pick that up in my reading. That's the way I felt. I used to think, maybe you'll blow up. Maybe your wife will blow up. We'll see how spiritual you are next week. And we were living in New York. We had the world at our feet. I was acting on Broadway. Life was really exciting. And we had a lot of fun. A lot of fun. We had our older son in New York. We were surrounded by friends and family. There were a ton of phone calls and He was really welcomed into the world, and 2 years, 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there were no phone calls, no friends, no family. We had been completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And Jesse was sick. He had to go to neonatal intensive care, and a doctor from the hospital called me and said, "You got to come down here." And I said, "I can't. I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. I can't come down." When Michael was five, he looked at me and said, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I looked into the eyes of my perfect five-year-old baby boy and I said, "Honey, no, there is not." And I swear to you, I thought I was saving him some skin. I thought I was giving him the real existential deal. And I lied to him. I lied to him. Even worse than lying to him, what I said to him was, "You know when you're scared and it's dark at night and you can't go to sleep? Tough, because that's all there is." That's really what I told him. I don't know if there's anything more abusive you can do to a child. And my wife and I just became just nuttier and batshit together. I mean, at one point I came home, we had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers, and I opened a cork on a bottle of wine, I emptied the entire bottle of wine into this glass, and I turn around and my wife is giving me the pre-Al-Anon rat face. And I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We became so sick that at one point we didn't have the rent. A guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live.
You sold my car?
I lent. That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, right? I mean, we didn't have the rent money. Big duh there, right? And I looked into my wife's eyes. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. That's what Silkworth talks about. And I looked into my wife's eyes. I said, you know, I am so sick of being an irresponsible punk kid. I am so sick of borrowing money. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car. And my wife looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, let's do. Now, I want to tell you something. I understand that. I understand that. That I was able to sell that car for the same reason that I got excited when I was told that I needed dental surgery. Normal people don't get excited about dental surgery, but that's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. When they told me I needed dental surgery, I go, ooh, dental surgery. Whoa, wow, man. Normal people don't do that. And I'll tell you why. I leave out the middle. I go from announcement of dental surgery to painkillers. I leave out the surgery. I leave out the sutures, the blood. I leave out the whole middle. I go to let's do the right thing. Let's sell the car. I leave out Grand Theft Auto. I leave out the middle. I leave out forging the name on the pink slip. I leave out the whole center section. If you're new, welcome to the middle. Sure, that's really good news for you. But we're really big on the middle here. You'll see a plaque, the most horrifying plaque in any AA clubhouse. Think, think, think. As my friend Cliff says, it's my problem. I can't stop thinking. Don't you love that look that newcomers, certain newcomers look like they've been ravaged by thought? And Nancy and I just became nuts. We the boys, by the time I got sober, Micah was six and Jesse was three, and they were just a wreck. Micah's small motor skills were all screwed up. He was reading and writing years below his grade level. He couldn't stop making these clicking noises with his throat. Jesse could not stop playing these robot war games. It just was safer to be made out of metal. He just couldn't get himself out of it. He couldn't. They were so distracting, he would go off in that world. And I'm not talking about reasonable, active, creative play. I'm talking about a child who was in flight of a bad place. It was just too scary all the time. If you get in between me and the drink, you're going to disappear. If you're my child, you're either going to become paper mache, something less than human, or you're going to vanish, because I'm going to answer the call. I'm either going to walk through you or I'm going to walk around you. And if I got to walk around you, I got to walk increasingly larger and larger circles, because it hurts too much to look at you. And how much vanishing can a child bear before they start disappearing? And what is typical in an active alcoholic home, and was very typical in ours, is our children started vacillating between becoming pointlessly aggressive en route to goals that never seemed to be able to be achieved, or they just throw the towel in and say, what's the use anyway? What an incredible mirror it is of that paragraph in our book where it talks about these things when the strange mental twist overtakes us and we're left saying, I'll stop after the sixth. What's the use anyway? How did it happen again? We can hear these things echoed in our families that suffer from alcoholism. What's the use anyway? You know, I'll try this insane, pointless endeavor one more time. The family disease is so devastating, and our family was devastated by it by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22nd, 1985, because on that day, 2 days previous, I did the thing that I swore I would never do again. I put a needle in my arm after 13 years. Why? Why not? I called my therapist of record, because as long as I had held that line, everything was okay. And that doctor that morning, who was my new therapist, my first Jungian therapist, said to me that morning the exact same thing that Carl Jung himself said to the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He said to me that morning, there's absolutely nothing that I can do for you. And I said, what? Therapy had been my higher power. He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or AA, or we have you institutionalized. Now, I didn't know that that's what Carl Jung said to Roland Hazard. I didn't know that until I was to come to the fellowship and read the book and find out. And it shook me up. And I could have had some doctor who could have said to me, come on up and let's talk about it. I think we had covered everything in the 18 years of psychotherapy. And why I went to that AA meeting, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why the guy I described to you before goes to the Caribbean island and keeps drinking. I don't know why I went to the AA meeting and never drank again. I don't know. I don't put a high premium on it, coming to AA and not drinking again. I don't put a high premium on it, number one, because some of the biggest winners I know in AA were chronic slippers in AA for years. And number two, I swore I'd never do it again a million mornings and did it anyway. There's no reason for me to assume that I wouldn't have continued to do that had you come up with this lame AA crap earlier on. Why I went to that AA meeting, I don't know. But I did. I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at 7 a.m. in the San Fernando Valley. Oh, first I went to one AA meeting. I came home and poured myself a glass of wine. And my wife said, honey, are you supposed to drink in AA? And I said, oh, sweetheart, they're civilized people. You can have a glass of wine. You just can't get drunk. At any rate, the next morning, I went to this AA meeting in the San Fernando Valley, and I walked in, and I took one look around, and I said to myself, oh, my God, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything was a miracle. Miracle, 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 miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The furniture and coffee are miracles too. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to start. I know that's going to happen any minute, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Get a sharp stick. Let's knock his beanie off, see what he does. I hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I hate it. I mean, and they get right up in your face and talk this endless, unsolicited reservoir of crap, you know? And you know the guy who does it usually. It's like a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it, right? You know the guy. He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on, right? Do I want what you've got? No. 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 But thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Clem. Do I bring my own bib overalls or am I issued a pair next week? When do we hook a rug? Because I figured the arts and crafts are going to come out any minute, too. That's going to happen. The only reason that I can imagine that I stayed is I was out of plans. I hated everything about AA. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan to this date is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. That sucker's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, I'm telling you, because that's out there. And I stuck around. I stuck around for 6 months. I enjoyed the gift of step none. You know the gift of step none? Nothing. And I knew I was going to drink. I had seen it hundreds of times. People come into AA, did the work, changed. People came into the AA, didn't do the work, didn't change, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, or shared their ass right out of the door, or stayed here and just became columns of human sewage and sexual predators, although I judge no man. Why? Because I'm just too darn spiritually developed. That's why. And I knew I was going to drink. And my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and had started pursuing a miracle, had a wonderful, loving sponsor. I came home one day and Nancy was had a bolt of gingham and a thing of ticking. And she was stuffing gingham swans. And I said, oh good, the arts and crafts have begun. Thanks, Mike. And what had happened was her sponsor got her right in the service, and she was working on the Al-Anon centerpieces for the San Fernando Valley Convention in our home group. And if you know the Al-Anons, the centerpieces are like floats for the Rose Parade, you know. They got like waterfalls, they're mechanized, they get very busy. They get very busy. Thank you, Mike. And the fact is I saw it and I was like horrified. And the fact is when my wife and I we talk about an Al-Anon newcomer, when Nancy wants to tell me that the person's getting it, she always says she has started to stuff swans. So when you become a swan stuffer in our house, we know that you're getting the goods, you know. And I knew I was going to drink and I asked the guy to sponsor me. I asked a guy to sponsor me. I was at the turning point, and in my own way, I asked for his protection and care with complete abandon. And I did the thing that I implore newcomers to do as much as I can. What I asked him to do is to say, am I taking a step toward a drink or away from a drink? That's the acid test. And the minute you say, well, it's kind of a step toward a drink, then it's a step toward a drink. If it's kind of a step away from a drink, do that one. But that's how my not drinking muscle has gotten so strong, 24 hours a day, from taking the step, turning away from the drink, and turning to this higher power. And the higher power has manifested itself in many, many different ways. At any rate, this guy took me to his apartment, and he spent hours with me for fun and for free, and I couldn't figure out why. And he took me through the first three steps. We said a prayer together, and he went back, and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step. And it took me 3 months, and I did that fourth step, and I went to him, and I read it to him, and I was 9 months sober. I did step six and seven for the first time, and I came time to sit down and write my eight-step list. And I want to share with you tonight, and I try to share this anytime I talk, what for me was simply the best reading of the eighth step I have ever heard up to this time. It happened, and I heard it years and years ago. I was brand new, and I was at a meeting, and there was a guy at the meeting who had never read chapter five before. He was there with a hospital group. He had hospital plastic on. It was at my old home group, which was this men's group. And his name was Nino. He had a heavy New York accent, and I've never seen him since, and I hope to never forget him. He got up to step eight. He was reading it for the first time, and he read, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you know what's in here, man? And I totally identified. It's the only thing I saw on the list. I did not see anything else. I looked at the list. I went, no, not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back. No way! Not the car! If you're new and you're worried about the eight steps, it's eight steps from where you are. What the hell are you worried about? Don't worry about it. And it's eight's not the annoying one. It's nine. So I wrote up that eight-step list. I didn't know what the heck I was going to do about it. Couldn't say I was sorry to my wife and my kids. I'm sorry were the two most useless words in my vocabulary. I couldn't even get them out of my mouth. It was like a mouthful of ashes. I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. Hanging with the guys, going to flag football games, coaching Little League. Showing up and running a reading group in my kid's second grade class. I had to start doing a lot of lame stuff. Lame. Went to my first Little League game. Nancy came to the game, took one look over and started laughing because there's all the people in the first base stands and there's me in the sun, pissed off, alone. I'm insane. I'm doing my job. I'm making amends. I was going up and down two hat sizes, completely out of my mind. The kids are thrilled to see me. Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man. Look at him.
I'm telling you, he's going to blow. It's a vein pumping on my forehead like a garden hose, you know, because I'm thinking.
And it took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number, for me to go and be able to sit in the stands with the people, to just be at my sobriety. Be with the people in the stands and hang. And a couple of years after that, my son Jesse received what I believe is one of the great compliments a human being can receive on this planet. He was intentionally walked. It doesn't get a whole lot better than that. Now, if you're not a baseball fan, I'll tell you what that means. It means they're scared of you and they want to get to the weenie behind you. And Jesse didn't want to jump up and down. And, you know, you got to be cool. He didn't want to be a geek. Just laid his bat down, trotted up the first baseline. And on the way up the first baseline, he turned to me. I'm at my sobriety station in the first base stands. And he turned to me and he just shot me just that much stuff. Just a little bit. It's the old man. You don't want to spoil him. Don't be lame. And I could have missed the whole thing. I could have missed the whole thing. And I'm not telling you Jesse got intentionally walked because I'm sober. I'm telling you I was there because I'm sober. And it was okay for me to be there. It just wasn't one of those awful times when I showed up again. You know? And I'd say for probably 14 years, we have given our children appropriate birthday gifts that they wanted on the day of their birthday. Not once have they gotten the day after radioactive guilt gift, or the day of the birthday, the only place that could take would still take a hot check for me. Here's some drywall, son. You know, drywall and a potted palm. Because Home Depot's still stupid. I was sober a couple of years, and my wife went into a store and wrote a check for something. And we had hung so much bad paper. We'd go back and hang more paper to take care of the paper, hang bad paper, you know. And the guy who she gave the check to looked at the check and looked at her, and her heart fell. And this guy looked up and said, "Is this your husband?" And she said, "Yes." And the guy said, "I just want to tell you, he's a real hero of mine." And my wife fell in love with this guy that day. And I sponsor him now. I've sponsored him for a long time. And he's just one of the greatest examples of Alcoholics Anonymous I know. And I just adore the guy. Just adore him. And we started making a family recovery. We started getting well. It says in our book, tell a man he can get well. And I want to get well, you know. I'm not going to get cured, but sometimes you hear meetings, I don't want to get well. I do. And I am. It says, tell a man he can get well. Well, wife or no wife, job or no job. Tell a man he can get well if he starts depending on this power. And that's what started happening for us. And we had some real troubles. The kids had some real difficulties. And I was about 5 years sober. When I was a year sober, I was sponsoring this guy named Roland. And Roland would call my house every night. He'd call our house. And he'd say, leave a message on our answering machine. And he'd say, Scott, it's Roly. I'm sober. I love you. Good night. He'd hang up every night. 5 years later, when I was 6 years sober, our son Micah came to me and he said, you know, Dad, when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the machine. And when I heard Roland's voice on the machine, I knew it was okay and I could go to sleep. I didn't know how I was going to make amends to my family. I couldn't say I was sorry. I told Micah there was no God. And you came and you got him. You came over the answering machine. You came and you talked to me at night. You came and did for us what we are absolutely incapable of doing for ourselves in a way that I never would have guessed in 5 million years. Roland's from Cuba, so usually when someone calls during the last minute or so of a major sporting event, it's Roland, because he has no concept of what's going on. So before the last Super Bowl began, Micah said, let's get it over with now. He called Roland and said, oh, what? And they just adore each other. They've got a great relationship to this day. At about 5 years of sobriety, a little after that, you guys told us to not get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We released each other with love totally. We lost track of each other. And I didn't even know, I mean, I had to stop working on my relationship. My idea of working on my marriage, my idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. That's it. That's the Scott Redmond Couples Workshop in 11 seconds. Talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go,
Oh, okay. I had to stop working on my relationship. I had to stop working on my marriage. We had to start getting closer to this power, the only power that could help us, and try to bring a better person to the deal. And we really lost track of each other, and I started really getting scared of my wife. And I remember it started happening for me. I'd hear her car pull up in the driveway, and I'd start looking around like, are the kids watching the right thing on TV? Is the house clean? And I realized this is what it's like to live with active alcoholism. And I had to finally, after a lot of inventory work, sit down with my wife and tell her I was scared of her. And I said, you're not scary. I'm scared of you. This is nothing you're doing. I'm scared. What can we do? And we started a long process of trying to get to know one another again. And it was very difficult. We had a lot of problems. And we went to therapy together. We did good work in therapy. And then would fail to take the stuff out of the therapeutic arena into our lives. And what started to happen for us, eventually, we started praying together. We broke down and started praying together. And what started happening was, because we started getting God involved in it, that line that we were trying to create with each other through therapy, we started actually being able to apply a lot of the stuff that we were learning in these other areas because we had a spiritual application. Silkworth says that we long imagined that some form of moral psychology was necessary to bring alcoholics back to life. Not psychology, moral psychology. What are the steps? They're a moral application for self-discovery. We're told to uncover, discover the things that will be of use when we do 12-step work, and then come up with a moral application to use them somehow. No therapist ever said to me, I've done this work with you. Go and talk to the people. My therapist would say, I've done this work with you. Try not to talk to anyone. Anyone. Just please, just shut up. But in AA, we say the complete opposite. We're like doctors who say, okay, we've given you a vaccine. Here's a whole big bag of vials and needles. Go. Kind of like that. And the prayer that started working for us was to not do the first three and not do 1, 2, 3, 7, and 11, which is something I'm going to do with my higher power, I hope, one day at a time for the rest of my life, but to finally be able to say, for me, to say, Pop, please, can you help me to stop taking everything so personally? Please, Pop, can you help me to have a sense of humor? Can you help me to remember that this is my wife, my lover, my buddy, my bride, not my adversary? Can you please help me to do this? And I started, and you know what? It worked. It really has worked. We've really entered a new, very romantic, very exciting period of our marriage. I'm really excited about it. We just celebrated 23 years of marriage. Now, I don't... I don't think it's because God likes us any better than the people who are getting divorced. I really don't. We got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. I don't know if you guys heard about it. I'm sure you did hear about it up here. It was terrible. We were right in the epicenter, right in the middle of it. We got whacked. And Nancy claims that I left a footprint on her forehead getting out of bed. I think she's lying. But we were at an AA function shortly after that out of town, and this woman at the function came up to me and said to me, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. So I said, oh, so he likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he just felt that you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. If I got a God up there that is saying, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy, get him. I'm out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with it. I know that God is keeping her sober. I know that God wouldn't keep me sober for 3 seconds. If I saw the deliberate hand of God in the suffering of other people, I want no part of God. I want no part of spirituality. I can't live in that world. I'm not telling her to live, although I would like to see her after her next lesson. But yeah. I judge no man. I keep telling you that. I had to get a God that wasn't involved in that. That's my understanding of my higher power. And I had to, I believe that I got to do my job in AA. If my job is, this week my job is to show a guy how to stay sober through having a successful, loving, romantic marriage. At some other time it might be to show a guy how to stay sober through a divorce. My God is not up there saying, let's see, divorce, marriage, skin eruption, let's see. And he's just not out there doling out the crap. Again, that's not a world that I'm willing to live in. And if you're new, I just want to tell you, you can develop a higher power of your understanding that'll make this a world worth living in for you. Our book talks about it very, very bluntly and in a very straightforward manner. It says that the framers of the book do not believe that God wants this life to be a veil of tears, that the higher power wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. This is the only recovery from a fatal illness, I do believe, that leaves the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they caught the illness. I really don't know of any other fatal disease that can lay claim to that. It's really remarkable. I'm a member of a home group that I'm very, very proud of being a member of. It's kind of an interesting story. I'll share it with you because we're going through some changes right now. The group was started so that we could create a space where gay and straight men could attend meetings together in a comfortable manner. I sponsor a good deal of gay men who we were attending meetings together, which there was so much sort of just off-the-cuff homophobia that it became so uncomfortable they couldn't attend the meetings. And it wasn't even, some of the stuff was deliberate, but some of the stuff was just stuff that's part of the common vernacular, and half the time people didn't even know they were hurting other people's feelings. But we went and kind of deliberately put together an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that guys, no matter what their preference, were able to attend together. And the effect of it has been incredibly powerful. It's been tremendously powerful and tremendously healing. And some men who have been sort of abused in other areas of AA, either intentionally or not intentionally, I judge no man, have been able to attend this meeting in a comfortable way. And the result is that people at the meeting have started to talk about what an incredible meeting is, what a wonderful meeting it is, and now we're starting to cross the line where maybe we're a little bit better than the other meetings. Yikes! So now we're taking group inventory. It's called the Pass It On group, and what I'm thinking is, if I got to quit AA to become a member of the Pass It On group, I'm dead. I'm a dead man. If I got to quit AA to become a member of an AA group, I'm dead. So it's an interesting process. It's a really interesting process, and it's really very enervating, very thrilling to be part of it, to be part of a group of guys who are willing to take a look at that. For me, it's a real mirror of what's happened in my marriage. It's a real mirror of what's happened in my relationship with my sons. I am very, very excited about it. Right now, I'm at a point in my career, I'm doing something else for a living. I'm in a sales job, and I'm working in a room with some guys who are absolutely pathological. They're very, very troubled. There's physical violence, threats, just complete insanity. And I dug in with my sponsor, is fond of telling me that people will tend to treat me the way I allow them to. And I've done a lot of work of just letting them know how they can treat me, how they can't. And so they keep kind of, you know, one guy said, well, what did you do before you got here? And I said, I was a prison guard. I was a prison guard for 5 years. And they all moved away from me. And so now, I'll say, you know, can you just keep away from my stuff? And the guy will go, oh, prison thing, right? And and that's the resolution I've come up with work. They all think I'm a prison guard. I'll probably at some point, you know, get a uniform, walk in there with a uniform. And that's what it's like today. But I was about a year sober, and I was becoming sort of a spiritual Goliath, sponsoring a lot of guys. And I had a screenwriting job at 20th Century Fox, and I was feeling pretty good. And I got an offer to direct a situation comedy. And I thought at that time, if I directed the situation comedy, that it really would benefit the guys I sponsor. because they would see me prospering and it would be good for them. So I didn't get the job and I almost drank. And I was humiliated. I went to my sponsor. I told him what I had done. And he said to me, well, I guess you have the show business God. I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you from drinking? I said, God. He said, so God keeps you from drinking and you didn't get a show business job and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God and he has abandoned you utterly. So I had to sit down and I had to do the 10th step. I was resentful at myself for almost drinking. I was resentful at the company for not giving me the job. And when I did 6 and 7 that day, my sponsor said to me, you know what? You're going to have a talk with him. I said, you're going to have a talk with him about what you're going to do to stay sober in this world. And I knew I had to get rid of the show business God. And that day when I did, you know, humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings, humbly isn't take him if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't, take them, you miserable. Humbly is, Pop, I'm done. Can you help me out here? I can't bear this anymore. Can you do my work? I'll do your work. When I drove close to him, he revealed himself to me. And I said, you know what? You got it. Take show business. I'm done. I can't take this anymore. And 3 months later, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God, and I said, I did not mean this. We have had a grotesque misunderstanding because I did not mean this. In LA, when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer. Caterer follows the company around, makes them food. It's a great paying job. You make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough because you're on a vehicle on a movie set. But I'm Scott Redman. The first morning... The first morning that I'm catering this movie, the guy, the executive producer and star of the movie, sticks his head on the truck that morning, and he says, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I went home, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I'm getting the gift now. Yeah, yeah, really. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful program, and I'm apparently really getting the gift. And my sponsor said, sounds like a resentment. I'm resentful at Scott for working on the kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. Now, resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual disease, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No biggie. Work a step a year. I'm going to die. You know, if you're new here, I want to share with you what used to be, when I was new, my favorite sentence in the Big Book of AA. And it could be yours tonight, too. It starts on the bottom of page 65 and goes to the bottom, top of page 66. They're assuming that you have written down a list of resentments. They're assuming you've written down a list of resentments of the things that people have done wrong to you, and they're assuming that you're looking at it. And they say, this is so beautiful, the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. That's enough for tonight. Don't read the next two pages. They're all bad news. Because what the next two pages basically say is, you're right and you're dead. It never argues with them. It says, don't argue with them. You're right. You've been screwed. They've screwed you. They've done you wrong and you're dead. Because you don't just dislike it. It doesn't just make you angry. You experience this resentment in a way that eats your brain and your heart and turns your world black and kills your ass dead. It eclipses everything good in your life. Everything. It blots the sun out. Now, if you could experience it in a different way, we'd say, fine, go with God. Try some controlled crack smoking. But we don't. So I'm going to die. This is going to kill me. It's going to kill me. And I had to sit down and write, what are the things that in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? Blue skies, magic wand time. God's got a magic wand. He comes and touches me on the head. What poison in me? What am I going to ask God to take away? The burrito, the truck, the guy? What am I going to ask God to take away? I'm ashamed. I'm impatient. I'm not trusting in God. I'm ungrateful. I'm working. I'm a people pleaser. I'm grandiose. I'm unwilling to accept the fact that I'm spiritually sick. I'm an alcoholic, man. I got a real problem here. And that's what I had to start taking to my higher power and saying, Pop, can you help me? I'll show up. I'll give them a dime for their nickel. I'll do anything. I'll do anything. Just keep me sober. And man, it started working for me. I started getting free. I was able to serve people who I had directed in shows, who had been my assistant stage managers. And I mean, on a movie set, the director gives crap to the assistant director. The first assistant gives crap to the second. The second gives the crap to the third. And the third says, where's the caterer? Now, years later, when I was back directing television shows at Universal, assistant director walked in to apply for a job with me. He walked into the room, took one look at me and said, not the caterer. Oh, no. Now, I had vowed to make every living, breathing moment of his life a living hell when I was catering, but I was much more spiritual then, and just the sight of him go like this was sufficient for me. I didn't enjoy it. Didn't. And I got to help some people who felt they had fallen from a height in AA. I had a friend named Paul who he had not reached the top rank in AA, which I believe is child of God. And once you reach that height, there's no place to fall from. And he hadn't reached it yet, and he had felt he had fallen from a height. And he used to say this prayer. He'd say, Father, I'm willing to do anything. Just keep me sober. I'll do anything for a living. But please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. And I cooked for about 3 years and got free. And I had an overture made to me by this company in New York called Ketchum Public Relations. And I was about a big time writing job. And I thought that at this point, after all I had been through, that if I got this job, my sponsees really, really would benefit from this one, because they had seen me suffer and now they would see me prosper thusly. And my brain blew up. I had to do a videotape for these guys. My brain blew up before I even found out about the job. I went mad. I had to write about it. I called my sponsor. I released it. And I was fine. A couple of weeks later, I get a call from Ketchum saying I did not get the job. I was fine. I get a call from my catering company to go up to the mountains above L.A. to cater a commercial. I get up there. I grab the call sheet, which gives you all the information about the commercial. And I see that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I looked down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera. I said, what are you doing? He said, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. So they're going to go back to New York with the tape and show the guys in New York, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? Oh, my God. I go home and I call my sponsor and I said, yeah, we're getting the gift now. Yeah. Yeah. It's a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. And he said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. So now I got a sales job and I'm sitting in this room and I had a book on the bestseller list before I got sober and there's guys quoting my book. They don't know I've written it and I'm in the room and I'm listening to them and I'm telling you, I had the same feeling I had when the meeting started and I looked at Harlan and I looked at my wife and I started to cry. I'm free. I'm just flat out free. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't believe you did this for me. You know, and I can't believe that we get to celebrate it together. I love these gatherings. I love meetings. I love these conventions. I love any celebration of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups. I love watching the committees go crazy and their brains explode, you know. I love to see it's like a big mushroom cloud of surrender. Boom, you know. You know, as people realize there's no president. And that's not my experience with this committee, by the way. I'm not, but I get to be at a lot of these things. So you meet the head drunk a lot. And I think this speaking thing is just, in a lot of ways, for me, just a lot of bunk. I think this is just a coffee commitment with a microphone. And I'm not talking about other speakers. I've grown up and been enriched by my sponsor as a speaker. I've been in danger as a member of AA of I've gotten special a couple of times. You know, and then I can become a circuit drinker. I went up to 300 pounds in sobriety, and which wasn't okay for me. And I could barely fit into an airplane seat to go talk at AA meetings and pass the word. And I almost died. A lot of it for me was spiritual pride. What does this have to do with AA and sobriety? Nothing, unless you're going through it. Absolutely not a damn thing unless you're going through it. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to just urge you as much as I can to stop treating your craving for a drink with alcohol. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. An obsession doesn't. I'm going to ask you, I want to urge you that when you have a craving, stop treating it with a drink and start accepting it and become available for the treatment here. Well, you can't get this treatment if you keep treating it. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You can feel it break over you like a wave. Take the whooping. You got to take the whooping. You don't have to do it alone. We'll do it with you. That's why we say keep coming back. That's why we say call us. That's why we say crawl on your belly. Exercise the not drinking muscle. Accept the craving instead of treating it. And the good news is our problem mainly rests in our mind, and the bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. There's no other book that I know of about recovery from a fatal illness that contains the sentence, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life." There's no book about cholera that says, "Cholera is a hoot. You'll love cholera. It's fabulous. You'll meet other people with cholera. You'll meet people who just caught cholera. It doesn't get any better than that." And because our problem mainly rests in our mind, because we have a spiritual solution, we are left in better condition than we were in before we contracted the disease. Incredible. The bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. And we trivialize this disease and we die from it. Some years ago, I was at a meeting. I talked to a newcomer. I got home. He called me up. And I listened to him for an hour. I said, four times so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he shared with me that he had been stalking several women. He had a restraining order taken out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober, and it's all different now. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, "I feel so alone." And I said, "What do you mean you feel alone? I hardly even know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. What do you mean you feel alone?" And he said, "I mean, I don't have a woman." And I said to him, "What exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What exactly are you bringing to the party today?" People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia are not having dating problems. They're concerned about their hair falling out. Alcoholics are, because we trivialize the disease. Some years ago, Nancy was walking through our bedroom. I was on the phone with a new guy, and all she heard me say into the phone was, "Let's say the aliens are coming." I said, "Look, I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. That's an outside interest. They might very well be coming. But I have one question. Why are they coming for you? Why have they traversed the universe for your sorry ass? You have 11 days of sobriety. You have no life. Why you? Don't you think they'll call the cops, mail a letter, something? Plus, he's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. They're going to traverse a galaxy, walk into his room and go, "Oh, no, the Bible, let's go home." Years later, I was sharing this story at a meeting, and the guy who I was talking about walked into the meeting. And I'm watching him while I'm telling the story. I'm watching him. And as I'm telling the story, I watch him go like this. I saw the horrible truth come through to him. If you're new here and the aliens are coming for you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Welcome to Eugene. Thanks, guys.